I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. I thought we'd talk a little bit today about the unintended consequences of Obama's great deal with Iran. Jim, there's a lot of ink being spilled right now, and I think there's some things that can be seen and some things that can't be foreseen on where this is all headed. But I think one of the unintended consequences that Austin brought out in his article this week was the coming nuclear race in the Middle East. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, as from what I hear from people, you know, Wall Street types, biculturals, I call them, the race has already begun. You know, negotiations are underway with China and North Korea. What an odd pair of potential suppliers. And even the Chinese are apparently upset by this, because what everyone, no matter which side of the political, you know, spectrum they fall on, everybody outside the United States, outside of the West, shall we say, where they have different attitudes, shall we say, than Westerners do. They're concerned about the fact that the religious zealots in Iran have such large influence. Now, a lot of Chinese businessmen have convinced themselves with a certain degree of truth that you can do business with Iranians, but even a lot of them, and I've had, you know, Chinese tell me this, you can do business with the right ones. But the problem is, it's the wrong ones. And they're the ones who are basically backing, you know, international terrorism, you know, a religious war with the Sunnis, and they all want nuclear weapons because that would be the fiery sword of Allah, you know, to achieve justice, you know, according to their norms. But the main thing we're dealing with here is, will the deal work? I would say, based upon historical experience, both in terms of Iran and in terms of the various nuclear containment treaties that have been tried so far, it won't. For one thing, as Austin has pointed out, there are some serious loopholes in the treaty. The one involves the inspection of all sites, especially military sites. Now, I remember, and it wasn't that long ago, if you're under 40, if you're over 40, so to speak, you probably dimly remember this, that when we were doing this business with the Iraqis in the 1990s, when we later found out they didn't really have a functioning nuclear program, but Saddam was faking it, as he later admitted before they hung him, that he was in order to keep the Iranians scared. Iraqis went through the inspection drill as if they had something to hide. That was part of, you know, Saddam's subterfuge, which he kept everybody in France, only a handful of people close to him that knew about this. In fact, one of the few people who knew about it and got away were his two sons-in-laws, who were lured back and executed. They got out of the country. I think got as far as Jordan before they were talked back in. And they basically said, look, there's something going on there, but the details, you know, made a lot of people in the West suspicious about exactly what was going on there. But the problem with Iran is that the evidence is there that there is something going on, that they're not faking it, and that with this loophole in the inspection routine, which basically allows you to delay it up to 24 days, inspecting a disputed, what the Iranians will suddenly declare as a military site. So they have 24 days to basically move whatever they got there. And they know all about our satellites and our electronic surveillance, and people in the intelligence community will tell you that, you know, the Iranians can fool some of the stuff some of the time. So right there, you know, if they want to play, you know, rope-a-dope, you know, where's Waldo with the inspectors, it's legal within the framework of the treaty. Now, the second thing is the other two treaties that have recently been enacted, one with North Korea and the other one with Iraq, we both know that they were betrayed, as it were. They were violated by the other parties. The North Koreans casually admitted it later, and there was a big, you know, the big to-do on in the United States about, well, we didn't know, we were trusting them, et cetera, et cetera. And then it quickly became very, you know, political. And nobody was interested in finding out, well, you know, what exactly can we learn from this? Apparently we learned nothing. And of course the one with Iraq, again, got swept up in partisan politics and trampled into the ground. I mean, the whole thing about, you know, some people say, well, you know, Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction, and they all forget the fact that Saddam admitted that he was conning everyone. And of course, if you read the popular media, which occasionally gets out in the media, they say, well, gee, at the time, we all believed that he actually had it. But because he couldn't find it, obviously someone in the United States must have been lying. You know, another conspiracy theory. Well, you know, we've got the same setup here, the same conditions, and I fear we're going to get the same result because, again, things you can listen to. If you know some Iranians, or if you simply pay attention to the Iranian media, you know, Iranian blogs and what have you, you'll know that they're all celebrating. This is a big victory. They're going to get their nukes. Even Assad's backers in, you know, fans, as it were, followers in Syria are celebrating. They're openly declaring victory. Now, they're not just talking about suddenly Iran has enough money to keep subsidizing the Assad, you know, government. But if and when the Iranians get nukes, the Assads will have a protector as well as a patron, because the Assad crew, as well as many Iranians, believe once they have nukes, nobody can mess with them. And that's what scares, obviously, you know, the Arabs, because, you know, the Iranians have been speaking about, you know, they actually own most of the Arab oil. And as soon as they get a chance, they're going to basically rectify that historical grievance they have. So, you know, this is a setup for peace in our time, so to speak.
Austin?
Gee. I'm not sure what to add to that, given the fact of what I wrote earlier this week. I'll pick up on a couple of things. Jim talks about this. Well, it's larger than 3 weeks, and in my column I say, you know, they start out with this 2-week ability to deny access of inspectors to what they call military facilities. Then there's a 3-day grab-ass period after that, and then another week, so it comes out to around 25, maybe 26 days that they buy off on it. But according I'm go and read this part of the text. It's available there. And it looks like that to me that if the Iranians choose to say no, this facility you haven't proved to us that you need to come here, they can pull that game. So this is where what Jim says that we're into a situation where the Iranians can continue to play what is essentially a shell game, and it's a permitted shell game, Dan, by the agreement. That's a huge hole in it. That is a major mistake. Now, I note this morning, too, that there are a couple of other commentators going through it. They've even gone and pointed out to a couple of major facilities. One of my I should have thought about immediately, but I didn't, and that is that Bushehr, the big reactor, is not mentioned, and that is capable of producing usable fuel. And there's another Iranian military site, Parchin, which I know has showed up a few times on, or Parkin, I think is the way they actually pronounce it, on strategy page, defined as military site. So you've got two major facilities, and this is I'm taking this. This is from an interpretation. This is not the word of the IAEA or the U.S. government or anybody else, but nevertheless, there's if there is a hole to exploit, what you have seen out of the Iranian government, just like Saddam, you know, is that they'll exploit it. and you start out with the other thing is a point I made in the column is that this is not a concluded deal. There are a number of major issues that remain to be negotiated. So I've talked about verification. The UN has got to, according to the document, and I do mention this in the column, has got to withdraw or annul all the old resolutions imposing sanctions, and then craft a new one. And the U.S. wants this new resolution to address Iran's ballistic missile programs. Well, okay, wait a minute. The deliveries systems are not, you know, they're open to do ballistic missiles. Also, with all the money they get, they're back in the conventional arms business, and there's no real restrictions on that. What Iran got out of this, what the Ayatollah Khomeini's regime got, was international stature, recognition, and money for signing what is a very flawed treaty that, if they choose to keep it, might do something. If they don't choose to keep it, there's, Jim says, you know, there's the nuclear weapons. We've got all the indication that they really are conducting a very aggressive nuclear weapons program. But look at all the other benefits they get out of it, and the benefits that immediately apply to troublemaking in Syria, in Lebanon, throughout the region, and occasionally the Iranians have engaged in global export of terrorism. They've been tied to incidents in South America and in Europe as well. I'm thinking of one of their through Hezbollah, one of the incidents that occurred in Bulgaria a few years ago. So you've got a regime that's now going to get anywhere from I've seen various estimates, $50-100 billion pump fairly quickly, and I had an estimate about how much their GDP would grow. There was a couple of European estimates saying it'd be 7%. I saw today somebody else was saying it's going to be 8%. Those are big percentages, Dan, and it does show how coercive diplomacy, and it was not effectively coerced because you always had the impression that President Obama wanted to make a deal. Reagan, whom President Obama says he admires, practiced insistent coercive diplomacy vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. We're going to have these sanctions on you. They're going to be political. They're going to be trade sanctions. Plus, you've always got us facing you down, and we're going to do some things you don't want us to do. And the Russians believed it, and therefore, as the START process, we got increasingly tough on them, and they agreed to the verification regimen that was pretty darn effective. I don't see, even though Obama's trying to compare himself to Reagan and the end of the Cold War process, Reagan practiced coercive diplomacy. The instrument that was signed this week is not coercive. And it is illusory, which is why Jim says, "Hello, Munich, 1938, peace in our time." And I hope he's wrong. I think he's right.
Well, you know, Austin, just I'd like to be at the next time you and Al have a coffee with some of the comments that went back and forth. Our other colleague Al Nofi has some different views on this.
Well, maybe we should have Al on here, but look at the points, yeah. I made about that and think about it in context, because in bringing that up, look, there's no other, you know, good friend of mine, Al Nofi, good gosh, man, and as erudite and informed an individual as there is on the planet. But the deal is I think I make a good point about the comparison using the term coercive diplomacy, and that right. But you know, Al needs to be here to do it himself. And of course, the thing right. is, with the volumes of information he has right on at the tip of his tongue, who knows? We all may quail and lose immediately.
Oh, right, but you know, it does bring out a good point, Jim. That we were talking about it. I think prior to the show was that this has become it used to be that America, when we were faced with making treaties and alliances and like that, usually we came together as a nation, but we have become so bifurcated within our politics lately that that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. People tend to want to go with whichever political party they feel affiliated with.
Yeah, you know, that's something else. Again, I'm a historian. We're all historians, as it were. And if you look at the political history of the United States, you'll see that it goes in waves, as it were. You know, there are ups and downs. There's ups and downs in corruption. We're seeing a lot more corruption now. We've had that in the past. We usually get past it. But there's also been ups and downs in partisanship. I mean, early on in the Republic 200 years ago, it was intensely, you know, partisan. It actually looked very familiar, looked very modern. But then it changed, and, you know, it goes up and down. And unfortunately, no one's really found a way to control that yet. You know, I mean, there are certain historical forces that, you know, seem to have an enormous power that are very difficult to, you know, to escape, as it were. Not to say you can't. I mean, for example, since the 1930s, since the Great Depression, there have been a number of economic changes instituted at the institutional level. And as a result of that, it hasn't been another Great Depression before the 1930s. What we call the Great Depression was a regular event. I mean, there were these enormous depressions. You know, basically, once we got into the Industrial Revolution after the Civil War, actually a little before, every 10 years or so, there was a huge, you know, recession, as they called it. But, you know, it was depression. By the 30s, we thought we had fixed all that, but we hadn't. And we triggered a somewhat larger than usual recession, mainly because there was more money sloshing around. But we have fixed that. The recessions have become milder and milder. Now, most people today don't recognize that because they're not looking at the historical trends, as it were. But nationalism in Iran is a constant that doesn't fluctuate much. I mean, actually, when it gets worse, the neighbors get a lot more nervous, and usually for good reason. I mean, for example, a lot of countries in the world are nervous at Iran because they have been run by basically unelected, well, elected once and then no more elections, religious dictatorship, which started in the 1980s, largely as a result of Iraq invading Iran, thinking they were weak, and Iraq could steal their oil because they were disorganized and what have you. Big mistake. And the repercussions were not just the war, which killed over 500,000 people, and Saddam Hussein going into a tailspin, which led to the invasion of Kuwait, you know, in 1990, et cetera, et cetera. We all know what happened after that. But it also gave the Islamic radicals, who were not a major power. I mean, they helped overthrow the Shah, but they were not powerful enough to basically form their own government. But with a war, and people, you know how people get when there's a war, when you're attacked, Pearl Harbor, you know, 9/11, et cetera. They said, okay, let the mullahs, you know, let them take charge. There's nobody else we trust, as it were. And so now you have this religious dictatorship. But throughout all of that, one thing you had constant was this Iranian nationalism, this Iranian belief in themselves that was somewhat justified. They have been the superpower, the regional superpower, for thousands of years, and for good reason. They're better organized. They create better technology. They're clever. They're aggressive. The one thing that kept them in check, and we haven't seen this work in our favor yet, was their constant fighting amongst themselves. You know, and that's how they got converted to Islam. They were in the midst of one of their interminable, their regular civil wars when the new Islamic army showed up on their doorstep, and boom, in it came. They had another unfortunate, problem 500 years later when the Mongols showed up. And again, they were, you know, somewhat off their game, and the Mongols just, you know, burned the place down. But the one thing that's always constant is Iranians are nationalistic, and they see nuclear weapons as their right. Most Iranians are against this religious dictatorship right now, which is held together by the fanatic, you know, 20%. Who will kill, you know, to keep the mullahs in power. But the majority, pro or anti-religious dictatorship Iranians, say, yes, nukes are something we should have. And that's just, it's a gut feeling. You know, again, it's a cultural thing. And that's what scares a lot of people in the neighborhood, because they know, you know, once the Iranians get nukes, they may or may not be that much more powerful, because even North Korea, they technically have nukes, but they haven't had usable nukes yet. And their country's also pulling apart, you know, around them, as we report about constantly. People poo-poo that, say, well, they're still there. I say, yes, but, you know, I'm a numbers guy. And going by the numbers, even the Chinese admit that North Korea is about ready to collapse, and they're basically deciding, well, how are we going to deal with this? No, we can't let South Korea unite the country. And we did report on all that. Now, most of that doesn't make the mass media. But when the North Korean dictatorship, the Kim dynasty, as it were, falls, then all that will become extremely relevant. Well, this business in Iran about the nationalism and the popular perception that nukes are our right. We have a right to have nukes. We're a superpower. You know, and they have all sorts of stories for why they've been on the outs for the last 100 or so years, 200 years, which is another thing we won't get into. We've gotten into on strategy page regularly, but that makes them extremely dangerous. And that's why, as Austin's been pointing out, you've got a nuclear arms race going there now. And while the Arabs haven't got the smarts, the aggressiveness, the et cetera, that the Iranians have, or the track record, which is more important, they do have the money. And
right.
And there are people willing to deal, especially the North Koreans. Now, from what I'm told, the Chinese have been telling the North Koreans, you'd better not, you know, go selling nukes. Because they're talking about Iran, they're also talking about terrorists. Now, the North Koreans have enough sense not to slip a nuke or whatever to a terrorist group, because they know that would bring, you know, everybody down on them, including the Chinese, who are at odds increasingly with Islamic radicals in their own country. But, you know, Iran is another matter, because the North Koreans respect Iran. And the Iranians, in their own way, respect North Korea. They say, you guys are, you know, make some dumb decisions, but you're pretty tough. You know, you're pretty clever. And you've done something we haven't done. You've flim-flammed the Americans. You know, you basically created a nuclear weapon under their view, as it were. You know, you made a deal with them. You lied to them. And then you got your nuke. And then they're sort of jealous. And that doesn't get reported much. I mean, the connections between North Korea and Iran are known. They occasionally make the news, but they're a lot more important than what is reported.
Jim just made a very interesting comparison, saying that I meant the North Koreans have gotten their nuke under the nose of the United States while negotiating with them, and that is that may be what the Iranians are up to. I certainly think that's. That's what's going on, and there would be respect for them. Look, the Arabs are plenty smart. What they lack is infrastructure to produce a bomb. That's what Jim's point was, but they've got the money to do it. And there was a Saudi I'm blanking out on what his position in the government is. I'll guess he's in the defense ministry or foreign ministry. He said that they can acquire nuclear weapons from Pakistan very readily. Remember, the Pakistanis were essentially providing them in, what was it, King Khalid military city up until about 1990, a 10,000-man mercenary unit there. I mean, Saudi Arabia has provided employment for the Pakistani military in significant numbers in the past. They're in a close relationship with them, and Pakistan has nukes. Pakistan is a source for the Saudis, and Saudis already have some IRBMs that they've got.
Chinese.
Yeah, they're Chinese. They easily get the technical personnel to mount the warheads. Will the warheads work? They have the ability to buy the personnel to make sure that the warheads have a high likelihood of detonation. And recalling when Jim, when he was answering your first question, Dan, said that the nuclear arms race is already on. Yeah, it's been on in a shadow way, but now it's serious. And there's also this component of it. We haven't talked about it yet, but there's shock among American allies. And I'll include the Saudis with this, because ever since the founding of Aramco, the Saudis have been pretty good allies to the United States, and the United States has been pretty good allies to the Saudis. Now, I'm not going to go into the history of Aramco, but there are reasons for the Arabian American Oil Company to exist and the relationship, and there's been some gives and takes and lots of disagreements, but that goes on in all alliances. United States has real disagreements with Canada and Great Britain. I would say that a U.S. alliance with Great Britain and Canada is pretty darn solid. And it's upset. Instead of just going down the Gulf Littoral, let's talk about the United Arab Emirates. The UAE sees the Iranians as their primary threat, and it is. And they have invested in equipment and bases and producing at least a little quality air force and some decent near-shore naval units that can integrate with U.S. forces, help U.S. forces, intelligence capabilities alike. And they feel hung out to dry by this agreement. This is diplomatic damage, political damage that's hard to correct, and it's hard to reassure. Now, they move to Israel as well. You know what you expected from the Israelis, but the Israelis feel totally adrift. There is a curious background element that some of us, and we've written about this on Strategy Page in the past, let's credit WikiLeaks with actually providing open source evidence of it. Everybody knows the Israelis and the Saudis talk to each other. Now, the Jordanians and Israelis always talk to each other. That was even when they were supposedly at odds, they were talking to each other. But the Saudis and the Israelis have regular discussions. And one of the WikiLeaks revelations was something that everyone had already presumed, and there was a lot of background chatter saying it. If the Israelis needed an air corridor to go after the Iranians, one of some senior Saudi official said, heck, we'll provide it. Now you've got reasons for much closer defense and security cooperation between several of the Gulf Arab regimes and the Israelis, because the Israelis have the technical capacity. They also have the reach, and they're not the United States, which I'm not going to use the word double cross. Okay, well, I just use it, right? But the thing is that there's a feeling of sellout, and there's especially why do you let these loopholes in? Why do you trust these people? You know, you're so far away. You know, this is where we're really not, but perceptually, you know, you're far away. We're right here, and we know what they're up to. And you didn't listen to us, and our interests were disregarded. Now, I'm collapsing a lot, Dan, into this observation. A lot of emotion, history, and the like. But it's there, and the damage has been done. Note too that President Obama is trying to assuage both the Israelis and the Saudis and the Gulf Arab states. Right now, oh, we're concerned. Oh, we know the Iranians could do this, that, and the other. But then why'd you sign the document the way it is? I don't know. These are fair questions to ask. And President Obama's treatment of a couple of reporters that have asked him rather pointed questions is I'm sorry, that's childish. Those are real questions, and they should have been dealt with when in the negotiating process.
Right, he slapped down Major Garrett.
Is that who? Well, yeah, you know what? I did see that.
Major Garrett was the one that asked him about the hostages
There've been a couple of other questions, I guess, of the White House press secretary about some of the points in the treaty too that have been there. But I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm sorry.
There are serious considerations that haven't been addressed. I don't know, Austin and Jim, is one of the concessions that we're taking them off the terrorist watch, off the terrorist nation list?
No, one of the good things about the treaty is that the sanctions and various other embargoes and various other restrictions are peeled away very slowly, you know, it's over years. And apparently the quid pro quo with the terrorism bit was, you know, all right, we won't insist on some concessions there, because I expect that the Iranian negotiators said, look, you know, we have factions, you know about them. We cannot insist that our radicals, you know, what he's really saying is, look, we have to let our radicals go play abroad, otherwise they'll play at home. That's how it was described to me once. You know, realpolitik, domestic style. And so, you know, but that means at the same time, you know, Iran is still a terrorist-supporting nation.
And that's why the money flowing into them is such a big deal, because that's going to flow into those coffers of the terrorists.
Well,
also,
the other thing to keep in mind is that the people who got their budget cut the least, you know, since in the last few years because of the increased embargoes, was the Revolutionary Guard. Partly because they are the ultimate, you know, protector of the Islamic dictatorship, but also because they control the Al-Quds force, the dark side special forces, which basically runs most of their overseas terrorism operations, and that's because of the ISIL. Everybody's afraid of ISIL. That's the only thing Iran and their Arab, you know, foes, as it were, opponents can agree on in the West, is that ISIL has to be destroyed, because that's another problem, because ISIL is created by the soul of, Arab nationalism, this Arab Muslim, I should say, because a lot of Arab Christians and what have you who do not believe in all this ISIL business. They believe that Islamic radicalism, any radicalism in the name of Islam, is in some way a good thing. Where they get upset is when a bomb blows up next door, literally. And that's why, you know, Saudi Arabia cracked down on Al-Qaeda after 2003 when Al-Qaeda broke the unspoken truce with the tragic kingdom, Saudi kingdom, and started blowing up things inside of Saudi Arabia. Well, that didn't last long. I mean, 200 people were killed by the bombs and the attacks, but suddenly there was no real presence, Al-Qaeda presence in Saudi Arabia anymore. But at the same time, the biggest contributor of volunteers for ISIL and Islamic terrorism organizations in general is still Saudi Arabia. And the Saudis admit that's a problem, but they created it themselves. But then again, you have to sit down and have a heart-to-heart. Ironically, I've done it over drinks, and fortunately I don't drink, so I had a drunk Muslim, from Arabia, crying in his beard, literally, about, the curse of religious, devotion, as it were, of piety in the Muslim world, because ultimately the zealots get in charge. And that's something they haven't been able to find a way around. Now, to give the Saudis credit, for nearly a decade now, they have been pushing this Arab reform movement, which basically, ultimately it comes down to changing fundamental beliefs, namely this belief in radicalism and this idea that this cultural thing that, whoever is more Islamic than thou has the final say on everything. Now, the founder of Saudi Arabia, Abdulaziz, he was able to play this like a musical instrument. He couldn't eliminate it, but he was able to deal with it. And his sons and his grandsons all admire, Papa or Grandpa for that. And they try to emulate him. But it's still a disease that can be, you can bring the fever down, but you can't cure the damn thing. And that's what they're desperately looking for.
Look, Abdulaziz was and I'm using this in the old sense of the word, Dan, a progressive guy. He, in many ways, for a his tribal warrior and the like, he appreciated technology. He was interested in all kinds of things, but he had to curb that to satisfy the Ikhwan, the Muslim Brotherhood was provided many of his warriors. Now, when they went through an interior battle there after the establishment of the kingdom to remove some of the most radical elements of it, because they were threatening to, they didn't like him. So the king responds. But the thing is well, I'm just adding a little bit to the what Jim said about why he's so revered. He knew how to he could walk that line. And but the thing is that, remember, he's also the guy that realized he was opening the kingdom up when he moved in and went into the oil business. He regarded it as being inevitable.
There's something else Dan was saying about, you know, Aramco. I have known a lot of Aramco people, you know, Westerners who worked over there.
Sure.
And I get some insights on it. And apparently, even Saudis agree that Abdulaziz was very shrewd in choosing America as their main ally. Because, as he pointed out, apparently it sounds better in Arabic, the Americans may be Western infidels, but they're not as bad as the Europeans.
No, that's all true.
Because, the British had been the protector of the Arabs and et cetera, for several hundred years, mainly to keep Turks out, who were fellow Muslims, but that's another story. But they thought the British were very rapacious, et cetera, et cetera. Well, actually, the British weren't that bad, but they were the first Westerners to get in there. And back in those days, the rules were different. And memories linger for a long time in that part of the world. The Americans come in talking about four freedoms and peace and a lot of prosperity, enterprise, and what have you. Abdulaziz apparently looked at us and says, we can work with this. And he did, and he was right, and that impresses, and that's one reason why the Saudis are still in power. They sell, the Americans may be SOBs at times, but, they're the most beneficial SOBs we could be dealing with. We need a protector. We don't want the goddamn Russians. We sure as hell don't want the Europeans. And the Americans have worked. Now, they don't work perfectly, but hey, they say they're infidels. What the hell do they know? So they feel like they're doing us a favor. And we go along with that, and that's diplomacy, mutual deception. And so far it's worked. But again, to give these Saudis credit, they realize they have some fundamental problems. They just haven't fixed them yet, but they're trying.
Well, right. one of Abdulaziz's advisors, European advisors, told the Americans to honor contracts. That was one of the things, and
yes.
He understood that. He checked it out. And he knew what he was getting into it. But he says you make a deal. He was talking about at a commercial kind of level. And sure enough, and Aramco's been a public private enterprise. But that's something that both sides have benefited from, which is that's what an alliance is about, mutual benefits.
Yeah.
I think we've kind of gone this one.
Yep.
Plus, we're the biggest customer and biggest supplier, but that's another story.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Right. That's good. I think that's a good way to put it, Jim. Sure.
Yep. Time to wrap it up, and we'll talk to you gentlemen next time.
Bye, guys.
Till then. All right.